Blog Talk Radio.
Weather today in the greater Cincinnati area.
I love you so badly.
They're solid plastic, so don't settle for imitation.
But the senator, while insisting he was not intoxicated, could not explain his nudity.
Welcome to Ringside Wrap,
a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we bring you the latest news and information on major pro wrestling and MMA promotions, the occasional history lesson, and interviews with legends of yesterday and stars of today. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Ringside Wrap.
Hello again, everybody out there. Welcome to Ringside Wrap, the legendary Les Thatcher, along with me, Mike Sempervivi. It is Wednesday, June 13th, 8 p.m. on the East Coast, and I'd like to welcome you again to the program. Coming up in about a half hour, we have the legendary Billy Robinson coming on to join us to talk a little bit about his career and his new book, Physical Chess, My Life in Catch-as-Catch-Can Wrestling, and an expert in Catch-as-Catch-Can Wrestling. Les Thatcher is here with us. Les, how are you?
I'm okay, Mike, and yourself?
No complaints at all. Missed you last week. Brutal Bob filled in admirably for you.
Well, of course he did. He's Brutal Bob.
He is.
I have yet to see his match on Ring of Honor. Have you seen it?
I have not seen it yet, no. I was there to see when he slammed Edwards and started all this stuff up, but... Yeah, apparently he's got a real good one, and hopefully he's got some good stuff coming up here real soon.
Well, good. Yeah, because I didn't think I'd missed it, but maybe they just hadn't aired it yet. So.
No, I don't think they've aired it yet. But Bob got a great compliment this week. Is the comedian Jay Moore? He's been in a lot of movies. A longtime stand-up guy. Was on MTV eons ago and was doing the comedy talent search on NBC not all that long ago. Openly asked on Twitter this week, why not Bob? I guess he's an ROH fan, and he was wondering aloud, maybe we should see more Bob Evans. So a nice feather in Bob's cap this week via Twitter from Jay Moore.
All right. An international superstar in our midst.
I wonder if he's ever going to become too big time for us now. Gas Bob's head up there a little bit too big, but had a bunch of stuff actually. Since we talked to you last, there was a UFC show on Friday on for free on FX. There was the controversial Manny Pacquiao Timothy Bradley fight on Saturday night. TNA had a pay per view on Sunday. And then we had the 3-hour Raw on Monday, leading into this Sunday's pay per view No Way Out. Les, I'll kind of open the forum up to you. All that stuff kind of taking place, much less the Brock Lesnar saga that continues to kind of float out there. What did you have a chance to see and hear about and pique your interest this week?
Well, all I hear about the Pacquiao fight is that Pacquiao should have won, except Bradley said Bradley should have won, which doesn't seem to surprise me too terribly much. I did not see the fight. I didn't see the UFC show either. Nor the pay-per-view, although I do hear that the TNA show was pretty strong. There were some surprises there. I thought that they took the belt off of Gail Kim. I didn't think it was any surprise that Bobby Roode maintained his title, and that AJ and Angle won the tag belts. But, you know, I thought the biggest, the whole Joseph Park thing, I don't say it disturbs me. It just seems rather silly. I can't imagine where they're going with the thing. At some point, it has to become apparent that Chris is Joe and Joe is Chris. I don't see any other way unless they end up somebody shooting and killing. Of course, Abyss killed his mother or killed his father for killing his mother, whatever. I forget how that story went. So maybe if he kills his brother, that'll be all right, too. I'm not real sure.
Well, the King's done that with Paul Bearer enough times.
And I saw that Brian had Joseph Park on an interview, and they talked about his law firm and everything, and I'm thinking, my God, that's pushing the envelope way past where, you know, it makes any sense whatsoever. But, of course, one Mark talking to another Mark just covers it, I guess. I don't know.
That's yeah, I was surprised to see. I haven't heard it yet, but I was surprised to see as much as I like the guys when they do come on here to do a good promo. I like to hear one. I was surprised that actually Brian and Joseph Park as Joseph Park did that. I got to be honest. For me, it's somewhat of a guilty pleasure, just in that. To be honest, I have nothing invested in Abyss, and if somehow they can turn this back into Abyss being the monster down the line at some point, I'm fine with it. I didn't think they could rehab that character in my eyes. I mean, it got to the point with Abyss where he was killing himself with slicing himself up with glass, and people would yell for fire.
Yeah.
It just, he was a comedy character then. Then he's a killer. Then he's got Hulk's ring, and then he's getting slapped around by Dr. Steve. There was nothing I thought he could possibly do where this guy was completely dead meat in my eyes. And this, I will say this, has turned that around. At least I'm into it, and I know it's, and it's hard for me to justify this, but it's, you know, I don't mind 31 flavors on my wrestling show. I don't, so this isn't bothering me because at least there's, I don't know, at least it's somewhat entertaining, and maybe I'm just
you've joined the mass. You've joined the masses of, well, for what it is. And
you know
this
what?
Is
what? Yes.
well, that's good. Then, you know, I can weed these shows out, and I can cut it down to where I have a lot of free time through the week because I'm not really interested. what frightens me is this will probably, the only thing I can see here is they come up with the fact that Abyss, Chris, Joe is a split personality, not like Foley did, but not Dude Love and Mick Foley, but when he's the lawyer, when he's in that personality, he can't wrestle. When he's the other personality, he can wrestle. And then I will turn that station off on Thursday nights and leave it off probably for the rest of my life. To move on to something that didn't make any sense either, I think I'm going to watch Love in the Wild, which, and you probably even know what the hell that is. It's on.
No, I don't.
It's a couples thing. They're in the jungles of Mexico, and they have the women pick the men, or the men, I forget how it works, but the men pick the women, and then at the end of each challenge, the winners get the suite, and the very last couple that comes in has to sleep in a lean-to or some damn thing, and then they can switch partners, and that's how couples get eliminated, right? And it's but anyway, it makes as much sense as most of the stuff I've seen in wrestling. of course, Raw's numbers were up, obviously to Vince. But you know, that whole 3 hours, I won't say it was a waste of time, but you know, the obvious thing is I think part of the reason the numbers are up is everyone expected Vince to fire John, which obviously is going to happen because now that Cena has to get fired if he loses. I guess I could go to Vegas and pretty strongly bet, if any idiots out there would take my bets, that Cena's going to win this thing. But hey, I love being told ahead of time what the other and his, the book is, you know. It's just that whole thing is just crazy. First of all, I was all of Twitter when I saw that there was going to be a mixed tag including Santino and Rico Rodriguez. So that right away just did it for me. Followed on the heels of AJ being Punk's partner. Followed on the heels of a four-way for a contenders match, and Kali had the fact that he'd been a champion was distressing. The fact that he'd lost his last two matches on television and there was a contender was even more distressing. Then I thought, you know, while we're doing comedy, Kofi should have gone and said, you know, he did this to my partner, and he handed both my partner and I our asses 2 weeks ago. This week, I want him just to hand me my ass by myself.
Yeah.
And then I think it was Lawler said during that match, well, you know, Kofi really didn't want to win this match. He just wanted to get revenge. Excuse me? Maybe he should have taken a 2x4 and waylaid Big Show in the hallway or something, which honestly would have made more sense, and it would have made, you know, it would have gotten Kofi over a little bit, which, I mean, he interview and everything, but other than that, he didn't get a, it's just, it didn't anything do anything for the tag team champions or him personally at all. And I just thought the whole end where Cena pretended to be Big Show's father, all he needed was a pipe where he could have pointed to stem at son, you realize what you're doing here. Which went on and on and on and on. And then, of course, Cena won his third handicap match in a row at the end of the show so we could send everybody home happy. So he's 3 weeks in a row. He actually has, I don't guess he has actually pinned Big Show, but Big Show, Laurinaitis, with a third partner, a different partner in each of the 3 weeks, have lost to Cena. So I, for one, can't wait to flop down $50-55 so I can see this match.
Yeah, that was the whole thing about, you know, I'm sure that, you know, USA is not even in the equation of this, but obviously they're going to be happy that the number is up. But I'm sure somebody there is all, you know, happy and proud of themselves that a whole lot of Vince McMahon equaled a one-night good rating for 3 hours. Gee, what a surprise that is. Did you make anybody want to, as you said, you know, plunk down that money for the pay-per-view on Sunday? And the answer is no. Look, here we go with acting jobs again, too. You know, one of the things I know we both love, you know, fine. Big Show puts on a good performance, you know, doesn't mean it's good for anything. AJ, fine, she's doing good at being the crazy girl. That doesn't make me want to see Kane and Daniel Bryan and CM Punk on Sunday, especially when you gave away the ending, which is she's going to be involved in the ending. And now if she's not involved in the ending in some way, there's going to be people that look at it as a, you know, as somewhat of a disappointment. It's kind of ridiculous.
And your standard issue, I say not yours, but let's Kane and Daniel Bryan forget their differences for a moment and be partners. Gosh, I've never seen that before. How many times have we seen that since the beginning of the year, for Christ's sake? You know, and how many times can Bryan, you know, I don't care how talented they are. How many times can Punk and Bryant work against one another and make people care? I mean, that's no knock on those two kids, because I don't care, the two greatest workers ever in the world. You have a shelf life, and at some point it becomes, okay, who cares? It is, you know, I don't know. You know, well, and that's the other thing, too, the whole thing with AJ jumping up on Kane, and it's just, okay. you know, I mean, it's just crap. I mean,
yeah,
it was Cole, I think, when they booked the Santino, Rico, and the girls. Wow, John Laurinaitis is getting creative here. And I thought, Jesus, have you got your nose up somebody's rear end?
Yeah, really. Might as well move into take a little short break here, because before we bring Billy on, I want to ask you a little bit about Sting in the in the Hall of Fame, in TNA's Hall of Fame, and a couple of other things before Billy Robinson comes on to talk about his book. So we'll go to a break right now and be right back on Ringside Wrap.
Georgia wrestling fans, you're going to want to make your plans to be at Johnny G's the first, third, and fifth Sunday of every month, 2 p.m. bell time, for Rampage Pro Wrestling television taping. And fans, if you're in Middle Georgia, make sure that you watch Rampage Pro Wrestling on Fox 24, Saturday 9 a.m. on the My 41.2, Saturday at 10 p.m. Cox Communications Cable, Thursday 8, Saturday at noon, and of course, Rampage Rewind, the one-half-hour show on Cox Communications throughout the schedule. Fans, be there.
Hi, I'm Jody Peterman. We know that no one understands what you need better than you do. We take care to guide you through the legal process, ensuring that you're able to make the decisions that are best for you. If you have a personal injury, criminal, or family law issue, please take a look at our website to learn more about our practice. We offer a free initial consultation for personal injury cases. Give us a call at 229-375-5680. We have a reputation for being accessible and treating our clients well. We look forward to hearing from you.
Hello, I'm Guy Terry of Terry and Peterman. At Terry and Peterman, we are committed to representing the hardworking residents of South Georgia in personal injury, criminal, and family law matters. For years, we have worked with college students in this area to ensure legal issues do not disrupt their academic careers. We also represent military families struggling with divorce and family law issues. We rely upon over 30 years of combined experience to provide aggressive representation for our clients.
This is Miss Rachel from The Empire, formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling. Every Friday night, The Empire presents the best in professional wrestling
at the Academy Theater in Avondale State.
We're also at the Masquerade every month or so.
Check us out on Facebook. Just look for Platinum Championship Wrestling.
And you'll get the latest details on all the hottest action from The Empire,
formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling.
We get it. That's every Friday night at the Academy Theater and at the Masquerade as well every month. We'll see you there.
All right, we're back here on Ringside Wrap. Legendary Les Thatcher, joined by me, Mike Sempervivi. And Les, TNA ran their pay-per-view in College Station, Texas, which kind of surprised me as a choice for a building, but it actually went off, or it came across great. It really did come across fantastic. The crowd was up. It was a real big one for their standards. I think it may have been like 6,000 or something like that. It just came across finally, you know, relatively big time, and they had a pretty good night. And they were teasing for about 2 weeks the fact that they were going to induct their first member into the TNA Hall of Fame, and there were a lot of rumors and things like that on who it could be. Lots of Karen Angle saying it wasn't going to be Jeff Jarrett, which, of course, made everybody think, well, maybe it could be Jeff Jarrett. And there were some other choices floated out there, but they decided to go with Sting. And what is your thought on that? I can understand how they could justify that, but how do you come down on Sting being the first one in their Hall of Fame?
I'm not a sentimental person in terms of the wrestling, but, well, I guess I am to a certain degree, but Jeff Jarrett, I think, should have got the first bid. I mean, I have no problem with Sting being there, you know. Obviously Styles has been on, been with them for so long and done such a hell of a job for him. But of course he's young and he's certainly not near retirement. But I felt Jeff should have been the guy, just simply, because until Panda came along and started pumping money into this thing, it was, and he's busted his hump there in a lot of ways. And somebody said to me, well, this goes to show you, how he's looked at by his partners or by the company. Honestly, I don't know how he's looked at, but I think it was a slight, Mike. Maybe he doesn't, and maybe he's cool with it, and maybe everybody else is cool with it, but I just I felt it was a slight to him, really.
Yeah, you know, what I was thinking was maybe that he was went to first and said, well, no, you know, do it for somebody else first so it doesn't look like, you know, any perception or things like that. At least that's what I would hope it would be, because I hope he was approached to be first, because I know obviously you can hold his friendship with Vince Russo against him, and, well, you should. It's for the amount the fact we're on 10 years now and TNA is in the spot that it's in and not bigger and not more functional. I guess could say a lot about that, but I've always been, again, I've been a Jeff Jarrett supporter, and the fact that he did kill himself and the fact that, you know, he has been a solid performer, you know, and their best one there for, well, over 10 years. I mean, over the span of 10 years. And the last thing he was doing with Karen Angle was one of the last entertaining things that was going on there under that regime. And I know he's, you know, trying to stay away a little bit from the limelight now, but I hope he was asked to be first. Although I'll say this, when it comes to Sting and that company, I guess, you know, all Hall of Fame is in a lot of ways is a lifetime achievement award. And for, I guess, if you're TNA and in TNA management, the brass of TNA, you know, Sting could have left at any time that he wanted to. I guess there was an interview recently where he talked about how close he was with The Undertaker about 2 years ago to do WrestleMania. I mean, he could actually leave there now and go to WrestleMania, and people wouldn't miss a beat. It would not be, you know, a shocker to see it happen, but he's stuck with that company, and they have, basically, they've really needed him. And you know, Jeff Jarrett, Kurt Angle, a lot of guys will probably make their way in there as long as TNA lasts. But I guess I'm okay with Sting from that aspect, I guess. You think they look at it that way, too, where it's just, you know, you could go at any time, but you've decided to stay here, and it's just kind of a thank you to them?
I suppose, you know. I mean, and again, I'm not adverse to him. I just, you know, like I said, I just think, you know, maybe it should have been Dixie's husband for throwing a great punch at AJ. I don't know. I wasn't with you last week. Here's my question. If it was so imperative, so important that we go to the ring and tell you the truth about this, even though it's going to hurt some people, and then two of my employees came out and shoved me around and I didn't fire them, and then I left and didn't tell anybody anything, and then thus far we've just kind of forgotten about it. So how important was it?
Yeah, this has been going on for weeks. Where has Serge been? Does he not watch his show? Does he not? I mean, where could you at least have said he was filming, you know, films in Morocco or something like that? Just any, this is where at least the Joseph Park storyline is played to me so incredibly tongue-in-cheek. That the plot holes in the Dixie one just kind of drive me nuts, too. Now, I guess if there's a silver lining in every cloud, it's that Christopher Daniels and Kazarian have gotten their chance to kind of carry a ball. It always would kill me a couple years ago where they talk about Christopher Daniels and AJ Styles as the next big thing in TNA, and Hulk Hogan. Every time they hit the reset button, they bring those two names up, and it's like, you know, Daniels is 40, I think. AJ's well into his 30s. They've been around for a long time. Everybody knows who they are. Utilize them. Don't just, you know, talk about it, how they're going to be the next thing. And AJ Styles and Kurt Angle winning the tag titles was, to me, a really cool moment because it was a really fun match. And to top it off, they actually made the belts mean something, whereas Raw was such a joke, you know. R-Truth gets knocked out. He's got a broken foot. Who knows how long he'll be out for, but they won't even mention the titles in that time. At least they made the tag titles seem serious, which, you know, for me being a longtime tag guy, you know, or just a fan of tag team wrestling, at least that came off well, if nothing else, in all of the story.
Yeah. I'm not. You know, it's just that whole thing is so convoluted, though, because correct me here if I'm wrong, is that Daniels used what he knew about Dixie and AJ to con Kazarian into being his partner, which I don't quite. I don't know what Kazarian. I don't know why Kazarian felt, you know, intimidated or in jeopardy because it wasn't he or his wife that were having an affair with anybody. So why did he feel that it was necessary? And the other thing is, like I said, you know, those guys come out and say, well, look, lady here, and don't touch me ever, you know. It's, wait, excuse me, but I think you work for her.
Yeah.
And why can you get away with this?
She was yelling in the truck. She was, why? Oh,
she was going to fire this. But, you know, why didn't she get all crazy out of her mind the first time any of this ever was made public?
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I'm shooting holes in it, but that's, you know, that's what they should be doing, is trying to figure out why any of this doesn't make sense. And if we're going to do it, let's at least try to, you know, to make it work. You know, little things to me, Mike, like her husband helped her up before he punched AJ. AJ took a better bump for him than he takes for most of the boys.
And then
after he knocked AJ down, he just walked out. Why? I mean, this is your best shot if you're going to kick his ass to do it. He's down. Here's the coup de grace is that she and AJ left the building. And I have done the baby. And you knew he was going to run in the tag match. You knew that was going to happen. I mean, I say you knew, I knew. I've been involved in that particular angle years ago. But he came in his wrestling gear. Does that mean that they went to a restaurant or someplace, him dressed like that? Or did he come back and get his gear on to run in the middle of a match he should have started in the first place? My point is, if you were trying to make me believe they actually left the building or that he wasn't prepared to run in, he'd had jeans and sneakers on or cowboy boots. And you know what I'm saying? He'd had street clothes on. He would have had street clothes on.
Well, and that's, you're exactly right. And that's, you know, TNA, Bruce Pritchard and Dave Lagana and whoever else is involved right now as far as tightening that thing up and trying to make storylines coherent and flow and move from, you know, instead of being dropped like WWE is doing, they are doing a good job in that. But as you point out, you do need to stitch up those holes as you go along because I think, now I've said this before a million times, they're kind of on the right path now. At least they're proving themselves over the last couple of pay-per-views and the TV, while I haven't loved every minute of it, and we won't even, we'll have to wait and talk about the gut check segment because I don't know if we, I know Bob and I talked about it. I hated it. I know Lance hated it. I want to get your thoughts on it.
Lance sent me an email and said after he heard me talk about it on our Saturday show, he hated it even worse than he did initially. And, here's the thing. And here's what Lance and I both thought as wrestlers and as trainers. First of all, if it was a work, it sent the wrong message to a bunch of very impressionable young independent wrestlers that this is the way they should treat veterans. And if it wasn't a work, the fact that Taz didn't knock him on his ass is just really in his favor. He had the luck of the Irish. My first comment when I saw it is, you realize, had this been tough enough, Austin and Booker and DeMont would have flipped a coin to see who got to knock him on his ass first. I mean, you don't, that's bullshit. I don't know how to say it any nicer, Mike. It's bullshit. And it's like I say, if it was a work, it sent the wrong message because, well, Lance said the same thing that I, you know, you work with a bunch of these independent kids. I'm not saying they're stupid, but they're impressionable. And they so many of them think I got to do exactly what I see on television to get over or to be noticed. And that, what he did, is the very last thing you need to do. You'll get noticed, but not in a way that you'll find it acceptable in your life. So if it was a work, it was totally wrong. It sent the wrong message. And if it wasn't, then the kid needs to get his ass spanked. That's as simple as that.
Well, to talk a little bit more about this, much later on here, as we're going to butt up against a break here, and when we come back from this break, going to have on a international legend, a very influential legend in professional wrestling and mixed martial arts and catch-as-catch-can style, and he's going to talk about that. My life in catch-as-catch-can wrestling, Billy Robinson, is going to join us after this break on Ringside Wrap.
Hi there, this is Sammy Hagar here for RAD, the entertainment industry's voice for road safety. Now, style's a personal thing, and your lifestyle is your business. But if you take it on the road, it becomes everybody else's business. Please, plan ahead, designate before you celebrate, because friends do not let friends drive drunk.
A public service message brought to you by RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
In 1977, an 8-year-old boy picked up the game of golf from his father. The odds of that same boy winning the U.S. Open twice, 1 in 1.2 billion. The odds of him having a child diagnosed with autism, 1 in 110. Ernie Els encourages you to learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Solie? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? What happened in Columbus on my birthday? Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
Want to know one of the best ways to help kids do better in school? Hi, I'm Patty Austin. I visit a lot of schools, both at home and when I'm on the road, and I hear too many students say, school's boring. And I say to them, what about music class? You know, learning music opens up the mind like nothing else. Performing in a school music ensemble is fun and challenging for kids. It encourages creativity while instilling self-discipline. And learning music even develops something called spatial IQ, which helps students tackle the challenges of other subjects like math and science. Some night this week, sit down as a family and play your kids some music you really love. Then listen to what your kids like and compare notes. Even better, sit down at the piano and sing some songs together. Help your kids learn to love music.
A PSA brought to you by MENC, the National Association for Music Education, and the National Anthem Project, the campaign to restore America's voice through music education. March is Music in Our Schools Month.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.
Fairy residents, this is Tooth speaking. I'm sorry, did you say credit? Credit Fairy? Perhaps you have the wrong number. Actually, no, I'm not familiar with the Credit Fairy. And I know all the fairies. We're a tight-knit bunch. Why don't you tell me more about what the Credit Fairy does? Maybe it'll ring a bell. The Credit Fairy magically raises your credit score so you'll be more likely to receive better interest rates? I'm pretty sure there's not a Credit Fairy. But I do know you can improve your credit rating by paying bills on time and keeping your credit card balances low. Glad I could help. Me? Well, I leave money under children's pillows. Adults? No, kids only. But I do know a good dentist.
There's no magic to improving your credit, but there is help, and it's free. Go to creditfairy.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the Consumer Bankers Foundation, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights Education Fund, and the Ad Council.
Oh, All right, we're back here on Ringside Rap, the legendary Les Thatcher, along with me, Mike Sempervivi, and for over 50 years, the influence of our next guest is unparalleled, a superstar in five continents. He was a revolutionary force in not only Japan's pro-wrestling landscape, but also became a forefather of today's mixed martial arts and continues to train and teach those who feel they're up to the challenge. His book, Physical Chess, My Life in Catch as Catch Can Wrestling, is available from ECW Press right now, and we'd like to welcome on Mr. Billy Robinson to the program. Mr. Robinson, how are you this evening?
Oh, pleased to speak to you people. Doing good.
Billy, why did you choose to write this book? You continue to train to this day. You continue to hold seminars, and you're involved in scientific wrestling, and your lore in the professional ranks, both here and in Japan, continue to grow and grow with everybody that you've trained and everybody that you've influenced. Why did you choose now to write a book about your life and about Catch as Catch Can style wrestling?
Well, Catch as Catch Can style wrestling died out in the 60s, early 70s, when all the old timers retired. And then Gracie Jiu-Jitsu took over with the MMA fighting. And then some of the old catch wrestlers said, hey, wait a minute, catch is better than this. So then they got back and went to the gyms and started to help the young kids out of the amateurs and stuff that were going into the MMA. But the thing is, the art of catch as catch can that comes from Wigan, Lancashire, England, is and the people that I was around at that time that were teaching me, it was just beautiful to watch.
Now, you write in your book, even though you come from a family which feature fighters, your great-great-grandfather was a bare-knuckle boxing champion, and your father was a legendary street fighter and turned boxer and wrestler. You write that they didn't really kind of want you to be involved in it, yet you ended up being, your father took you to learn some things, and how did that come about, and what were the feelings of your mother coming from a fighting family that you were going to be involved in wrestling and boxing?
Well, she hated it. She never came to one of my amateur matches or professional matches. Yeah. She just didn't like it. But I was going to be a boxer until I had an eye accident when I was 12. I was already training boxing at that time. I mean, my Uncle Alpha, Max Baer, and my dad was North of England champion in pro boxing, apart from street fighting. So I came from that type of family. And times were different in those days. It's hard to explain to kids now. There were no cell phones. Sex wasn't a common thing with kids. You take a girl out for 6 weeks just to get a kiss in those days. Nobody had any money. So all the kids used to go to the different gyms, whether it be rugby, wrestling, boxing, whatever. And when you went to all these gyms, and there were plenty of gyms, you'd have a lot of different sparring partners to get on the mat with. And the thing nowadays that is the problem is that you get a good gym where some good guys come out, but they've only got three or four sparring partners. Now, when this happens is, after a period of time, they get used to each other. They know what the guy's going to do before he's going to do it because of the regular working out. So they don't improve. The standard goes down. You have to go to other gyms. You have to spar regularly with different opponents because everybody reacts differently. So you can't set in your mind, well, I'm going to do this, and then he's going to do that, and I'll counter him and take an ankle submission or a neck crank. It doesn't work that way because everybody reacts different. What was good about the old days is that you go to the gym, there'd be 30 different guys who you've never seen before in the gym waiting to get on the mat. And it was just great. All the old timers would be around. As a young kid, they'd come pull me to one side and they'd say, "Listen, son, if you just drop your shoulder a bit further under his armpit or come around to about a 30 degree angle, you'll find it a lot easier." And it was like, no matter what I did on the mat, there was always somebody improving it for me. And that's what I tried to teach.
Now, proponents of catch-as-catch style wrestling believe it's far more difficult than jiu-jitsu training is, not only because of the style, but the entrenching training that's involved. I know Josh Barnett has talked about long chains and Ironmans and things like that, where a lot of jiu-jitsu, you know, proponents that sit there and hold the torch for the Gracies only do that because they don't have enough fortitude to stand in there and to go to some of these gyms and learn the catch style because it's too difficult for them. Have you found that to be a issue where a jiu-jitsu guy who swears by it walks in and just can't handle the training of the catch style?
Well, the problem is now with amateur wrestling, this Olympic style wrestling, they've cut the time periods down so much that it's just power now. They get 1 point ahead and then just hold on for the next 2 minutes or whatever. And it's just become very boring. You go back in the 60s and before, when it was, okay, let me tell you. When amateur wrestling freestyle started in the Olympics, I think it was either the 1908 or 1912 games in England when freestyle started. And it was called amateur catch-as-catch-can. But there was no time limits then. The longest match for the gold medal, for the heavyweight gold medal in the Olympic Games, was 11 hours, 20 minutes, non-stop. And then after that, they cut it down to 1 hour. And then after that Olympics, they cut it down to 15 minutes because the matches were just taking too long. But now they've cut it so far down, and they've got, you can't get cross faces, three-quarter Nelson, ankle locks, double wrist locks in amateur wrestling, where they used to be in the old days. So amateur wrestling has gone backwards. There's no real catch gyms anymore, other than Roy Woods in Wigan, England, that's kept. He was a young boy when I was there, and he's kept a gym going. But very, very few good catch wrestling gyms in the world. And what's happened now is people are watching stuff on video and everybody's calling it catch, and they're going to see the different videos. And that's not catch. Learning how to do a submission when a guy allows you to get the position, you've learned nothing. You have to learn how to get to the position to get the submission. But that's... Sorry.
Is it a manner for a lot of these guys that come in, they basically need to learn... Basically, they need to learn how to learn, essentially, where to break them of bad habits and to break them of those repeated, you know, facing those same repeated guys at gyms and falling into bad habits? Do you basically have to reprogram them in these seminars to teach them what, you know, basically for all intents and purposes to learn how to learn again?
Well, that's what Billy Riley used to say. I'm not teaching you to wrestle. I'm teaching to learn how to learn. And then you'll never stop learning. But the thing is, what is lacking now are just fundamental basics. And there's no old-timers to show the people fundamental basics. For example, if somebody's playing with your ankle, you don't continue to try to get a headlock or a double wrist lock or whatever you defend that ankle, because the ankles are the most vulnerable part of the body as far as catch wrestling. You can roll into an ankle submission so fast. It's ridiculous. But if you just think, oh, well, I'll get this, or I'll get his... I see them in MMA now. One guy's got one leg, and the other guy's got the other guy's leg, and they're both trying to get the submission. You just don't do that. You have to defend your ankle first, get it out of there, and then start again. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but I...
Oh, yeah. Less?
No. Go ahead. I'm fascinated. I'm enjoying listening. I'm going to school.
Well, Billy, when it comes to like today's, like, because I do see a lot of guys like the Josh Barnett's of the world, and Kazushi Sakuraba is arguably the greatest mixed martial artist, or at least to many, the man they hold at the pinnacle of what mixed martial arts is, and you had a large hand in training him in UWF in Japan. You talk about these older guys who, and they're kind of going away, and the style, there's not the people to show the style. Do you believe this is something that can continue on through the spirit of these others and trying to teach, or do you have a fear that it is going to go away or morph into something that it shouldn't be?
No, well, the problem is now they've intermixed it with television and video cameras where you can watch all the different styles, because there was none of that. When there was no television or no video cameras that you can take videos with on the matches and stuff, guys used to come in from one style and combat against another style, and nobody knew the different styles. In those matches, the catch wrestler would beat anybody in the world at any martial arts sport. But now it's like they've got a figure four, and the jiu-jitsu guys call it a triangle. You've got a kimura, which is a double wrist lock. It's been a double wrist lock for 4,000 years before jiu-jitsu was even thought of.
Does it make you happy at least with the success of the Randy Couture's and the Sakuraba's and the seemingly when people got around to what the Gracies were truly doing when it came to the UFC and in Japan, where they basically were showcasing themselves to get to a certain point. When people caught up to that, the wrestlers took back over, or at least the amateur wrestling style of the Couture's and those types of guys seemed to take back over. Are you proud of that, at least, that even today the amateur wrestling style and the wrestling style seems to be the most dominant when it comes to the MMA, the cross of MMA styles?
Oh, yeah, but I'm sure I'm proud. But I want them to be more dominant. Right now, where the MMA style is, that the promoters and the television people want more striking and kicking to make it exciting for the audience. But what they've really got to do in MMA is get all your styles together and get one set of rules, which they don't have at the moment. Once they get one set of... In the old days, you get professional boxers. In the 60s, you had only eight world champions, eight different weights. And everybody in every country knew the name of every world boxing champion. Now you've got 16 divisions and five or six different promotions. You've got 80 world champions out there that nobody knows the name of. And that's what's happening with MMA now, with the different organizations. And it should be just one organization and one set of champions, in my opinion. I mean, that's what I think anyway.
Now, when it came came to the changing the, around the Japanese landscape, you had a chance to do that with Antonio Inoki in the 70s. We talked to a man last week by the name of Jonathan Snowden, who wrote a book called Shooters, the toughest men in professional wrestling, where he goes back to former Burns and chronicles different styles. But one of the names we talked about was Antonio Inoki. And he was reluctant to talk about, because obviously Antonio Inoki had a business to run, and he had, you know, a certain aura about him. He didn't really get into his toughness at all, and you working so much with Inoki and so closely with Inoki for so long, how tough was Antonio Inoki?
I just had one match with Inoki.
Oh, really?
And then he wouldn't mess with me again. No, he was... Okay, Karl Gotch, his real name was Karel Istas from Belgium. My uncle took him to Wigan after the 48 Olympic Games. And that's where Karl learned the submission wrestling. And Karl's about 12 years older than I am. So then he went to left England and went to America and then finished up in Japan and with Vicky Dozan. And then Dozan died, and then they called Karl over to train the Japanese wrestlers. And then Inoki was one of his very young boys when he started. And that's where Inoki learned how to wrestle. But Karl comes from the same gym as I do, and had the same coaches, Billy Riley, Billy Joyce, Bob Robinson, Joe Robinson, all those old guys. So we've got the same coaching, you know, the same ideas.
You know, that dojo style that you know, especially Karl Gotch gets so much credit for when it comes to New Japan, has changed dramatically over the years in Japan. Do you keep up at all or talk to anyone involved in the professional aspect of things over there, because there's been very few to come out. New Japan has tried to recycle its traditional dojo method. They've had one foreigner by the name of Fergal Devitt from Ireland who has come out of there, but they are trying to go back apparently to their roots. Do you talk at all or hear at all about the wrestling over there and how it's run today?
No, really. Miyato, who books for Inoki's organization, I talked to him because he was the head of the UWFI and the UWF with Takada and stuff. Miyado was one of the top guys there then, and then became the booker. And he has the Snake Pit Gym in Tokyo in Koenji. So I'm in touch with him and the wrestlers that I've coached around him. Like, we've got a young MMA fighter there called Inoue, who is the champion over in Japan, that I coached from being about 15. But the professional end of it, I'm not in touch with anybody now. Not even in America. Oh, I've just lost. Professional wrestling to me now has become so much of a show that it doesn't resemble wrestling to me anymore.
No, we talk about that every week on this program. Les, who for years, you know, wrestled around. Did you guys ever?
We've never met. Billy, I've got a question. When I was a young man, I've heard so much about Bert Austeri.
Bert Azzarotti.
I knew I didn't have it occur. I always heard that he was such a tough guy. Did you ever have occasion to work out with him or to wrestle him?
Oh, no, he was older than me. My uncle wrestled him many times, and I knew Bert, and I knew him very, very well. As a matter of fact, just before he died, he was asked, he was the best wrestler that ever came out of England. And surprisingly enough for me, he said Billy Robinson. So that was terrific for me. But Bird was maybe 5'8 at the most, 280 pound. He was like 4x4. He was a sadist. He loved to hurt people. But he was also a masochist. he didn't mind getting hurt. When he was a young man at 13 years old, he was a catcher on the high trapeze and with the Italian circus. That's how he got. He was a strong man. Worked in the Italian. Great hands on him. That's why he was a catcher. But he was a very dangerous man. He would have been great in MMA because he was basically an exceptionally powerful, conditioned street fighter.
Yeah, I've heard Thez talk about him a little bit, too.
Well, Thez and he, that situation arose, like Brizad Arazi had his own wrestling promotion, and the big promoters in England were joint promotion, and they brought Thez over. So Azaradi wanted to challenge Thez at the Royal Albert Hall, and the promoters, joint promotions, had the police waiting outside and wouldn't let Azaradi into the arena. Now, I asked Thez about this, and Lou and I were good friends. He said, yeah, he said, I didn't know anything about it until later. He said, I'll wrestle him anytime. So, and I believe Lou would have. Everyone who asked me who would I think would have won, I would have said it's a toss of a coin. You got two different styles.
Uh-huh. All right. There were a lot of good amateurs in the AWA when you were there. I were guys who had been good amateurs, right? Scarpello, Byrne, Geigel.
When I was there, I started for them in 72. The best wrestlers there were Vachon, who was a gold medalist in the games for Canada. Maurice Vachon, not Paul.
Right.
And who I considered one of the best guys was Jim Raschke, Baron von Raschke.
Yeah.
And he just was very unfortunate. I think he was like 8 or 9 times national champion. But every time he came to the Olympics, he got injured, his knee or whatever. Jim was a big, strong guy. Very, very supple. One of the nicest guys in the business and a very close friend. But he impressed me because in my time, the best heavyweight, probably the best ever Olympic heavyweight was Medved from Russia. And Jim, as a young man, went to Russia and wrestled into a one fall, a 15-minute match. I mean, a one point. So Medved, you know, had a real hard time beating Jim Raschke. And then unfortunately for the Olympics, Jim got injured, so he never did go to the Olympics.
But did you and Hodge ever get a chance to work out?
No.
Well,
we've been together and played around, but no, we not worked out. A funny story, if you want to hear it. We're there, we're making the movie, The Wrestler, in 73. And Hodge is there, and Danny and I are there, and we've just done the whatever we were doing for the movie, and we're going to get something to eat. And Garnier comes up, and he's trying to get me and Danny into a match. So I said, Danny, look, let's go and shoot. I said, let's wrestle. I said, but you've got to promise me one thing. If you beat me or I beat you, we both kick the shit out of Vern Garnier afterwards. And Vern went, no. I was just joking.
You brought up Medved there, too. You know, he was a three-time Olympic champion. You were a European champion, like 57, 58. Was there any reason that you decided to not try to apply your wares at the Olympic Games in 60?
Okay, let me explain to you this, and so the people that are listening to this, if they can understand my voice, I had an operation on my neck, and it's messed my voice box up, so I hope you can understand me. But no amateurs in the world that can compete with the pros. The thing being that before the war, the Second World War, everybody was starving in Europe. The working class people. So anybody who got good at any sport, they turned pro to make extra money to put food on the table. It's only when, after the Second World War, in the 50s, when the economic boom started and people were starting to earn a little bit more money, did things change. I mean, when you talk about boxers, I think that the first guy to win a professional world championship from being an Olympic champion was Floyd Patterson, and that was in, what, 64? And then, I think 60 or 64. Then Muhammad Ali, and Floyd was a middleweight in the Olympics. And then you got after him, it was Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay. And Cassius was more like, I think he fought at 175, or he was light heavyweight. He was light heavyweight anyway. He wasn't a heavyweight, I think. But the thing is that all you good fighters and in all your martial arts sport turned pro before the 60s. Now, when I won the... I wrestled two weights in the European Championships, light, heavy, and heavy. I won the light heavyweight by beating, and this is 57, so 56 Olympics. The bronze medalist, and there was Jerry Martina, and I beat him for the gold medal. And then in the heavyweight, I wrestled the same tournament, Ken Richmond. I got beat by Ken Richmond. He was a lot bigger than I was. But he had a silver medal in that Olympics. And then 68, when the Olympic team in Sweden challenged the pro wrestlers, they called for me. I wrestled the whole Olympic team and beat every one of them.
Billy, I cannot thank you so much, you know, enough for coming on the show this evening and doing this with us. And your book, again, Physical Chess, My Life in Catch-as-Catch-Can Wrestling, is available through ECW Press in both paperback and electronic form. And wish you nothing but the best, and look forward to talking to you again in the future, sir.
Well, so much respect, and thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me on. Just one thing, if anybody wants to get in touch with me or Jake or talk about wrestling and stuff, you can email him at certifiedcatchwrestler.com.
All right, Mr. Robinson, again, thank you so much. And for everybody, we're going to be back here, Les and I, on Ringside Wrap right after this break.
Hi, I'm Ryan Seacrest for RAD. Over 300 people in this country are killed every week by a drunk driver. That's the equivalent of 2 747 plane crashes every single week. And the problem isn't going away unless we all do our part to stop it. So if you see someone who's about to drive after drinking, get the keys. Don't leave it up to anyone else. Friends don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service announcement brought to you by RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
I present to you three of the fiercest subjects ever assembled in the Cage of Doom. First, the brain-wrenching behemoth Algebra 2, weighing in at a mind-boggling 800 pounds. Foreign languages! The multilingual international sensation capable of tossing you clear across the Atlantic. And finally, biology. More ferocious than formaldehyde, she'll dissect you one chromosome at a time. Who among you will step up to their challenge?
Yeah, I'll do it.
Me too.
I'm in.
Sign me up.
Take on the tough classes now. You need them to prepare for college. Find out which classes you need at knowhowtogo.org.
Brought to you by the American Council on Education, Lumina Foundation for Education, and the Ad Council.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Solie?
Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
Homework, soccer, part-time jobs, the internet. Are you and your busy kids overlooking something important? Don't forget music. Hi, this is Sarah Evans. Studying music is one of the most valuable ways a student can spend time. Practicing music reinforces teamwork, communication skills, self-discipline, and creativity, all qualities kids need to be successful in their other schoolwork. These skills will help kids later, too, in their jobs and in society. Help your kids learn that there's more to music than what they hear on the radio. The more they learn about it, the more they'll enjoy listening to their favorite tunes. Then, maybe, they can even explain to you why they think their own music is so cool. Hey, turn off the TV and play music with your kids.
A PSA brought to you by MENC, the National Association for Music Education, and the National Anthem Project, the campaign to restore America's voice through music education. Music, part of a sound education.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard, ride a bike, or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
And be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
At letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
All right, we're back here on Ringside Wrestle. Legendary Les Thatcher, along with me, Mike Sempervivi, and I'd like to thank Billy Robinson again for coming on. And that book, Triskel Chess, My Life in Catch-as-Catch-Can Wrestling. And Les, you had a chance to cross paths with, you know, Les Thornton, Tony Charles, and a lot of guys who were very good on the mat. Listening to Billy Robinson talk there, who were some of the guys that kind of taught you? You know, some of the catch wrestling is known for debilitating hooks and holds and manipulation and learning how to submit the body from, you know, being in any position possible and defending those. You obviously had to learn a lot of that to defend yourself coming up when you did in the business. Who taught you some of those things, and who did you look at with respect?
Well, you know, it just you picked up a lot. Some of the old-timers, well, Ronnie Hill, who I had my first professional match with, was he and a guy by the name of Kurt Douglas, and that was his real name. It was not the movie star. Killer Douglas is what Santos booked him as. We're both pretty damn salty and good. They were the two major stars when we worked the fairs and the carnivals in New England. The rest of us were just kind of fill-ins, but I mean, Ronnie was wiry and tough. Kurt was a bigger guy, and then there was a lot of the Manuel Bonica, Nick Valley, of the old timers that were up there that would get in and play with you a little bit, tug around with you, and you know, some of the stuff you just kind of sit and you listen. You don't. I mean. Having watched, like, Gotch, you know, buying tickets to watch Carl Gotch. And you sit in the dressing room and listen to Gotch talk. You didn't say, "Show me, Carl." You had to be smarter than that. Or he may have. You know, but
that was the Stu Hart method, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I never went to the dungeon. I was invited, but I told Stu I was fine. Thank you very much. I'm good for this. But you know, I didn't have to deal with a lot of that, honestly. You know, there's some guys, you know, they'd want to test you and sting you a little bit and see how you reacted to it. But, it was never, I never went in with the idea that I was, you know, that I was special. I went in to learn and learn I did, you know, but that's that was the guys up there. I mean, it was, funny, Bull Montana was the second man I ever worked with, and he was a stocky, squatty, a mean-looking guy. If you were looking for the book of villain in some kind of masher movie or, you know, serial killer thing, Bull might have been the guy. And I'm thinking, my God, this guy is just going to be, I was ready for why, you know, expecting something, and the truth was he was so easy and so loose. I almost walked out of a headlock. I was so nervous, and he squeezed us a little bit and said, "Stay here, kid." But so, you know, so that, and you see, that's the difference too, I think, Mike, then and now, because a lot of the legitimate tough guys were not hard to work with. I mean, now if you went out there and wanted to show them who you thought you were, then that was a horse of another color. You know, Hodge was not hard to work with. Bill Miller, I remember, well, you know, I think I probably saw Bill Miller's very first professional match. And Bill, was a Big Ten champion and played on the Ohio State Rose Bowl football. I think it was in 50 or whenever they won the Rose Bowl. Anyway, and Bill had a reputation for having a temper. First time I ever worked with Bill was in Huntington, West Virginia. And, of course, it was quite a size difference. I hadn't filled out at that point either. But Bill Miller was a big guy by the standards of that day. And I was a little nervous and leery, and Bill came and sat down and said, "I understand we're fellow Buckeyes." You know, for those of you who don't know, that's Ohioan. We are Buckeyes here, or the Ohio State Buckeyes if you follow football. And I said, "Yeah, since you know." So anyway, obviously I was going to do the job for him, and but he said, "Now he said we need to make you look good, you know." So I beat somebody. And, you know, he laid out some spots and called some stuff out there and got me over like $1 million, you know, even with the size difference. And you know, it was just easy as hell to work with. So, I mean, Don Curtis was a hell of a shooter. I worked, the first match I ever had in the Tampa territory was with Don. And he came in and sat down next to me in the dressing room at the old Fort Hester Lay Armory and introduced himself. And by the time we went to the ring, we were friends. And up until the day he died, we were fast friends. And I have so much respect for him. But I got, you know, to work with some very, you know, I used to mention Hodge, Matsuda, some extremely tough guys who were not hard to work with. Now you find a lot of guys who, I guess they have testosterone questions or something. I don't know. I know just to demonstrate things when I do camps, sometimes I'll lock up with a kid and you know how sarcastic, I'll say, "Are you mad at me?" "No, sir." I said, "Well, then loosen up, man. This is, you know, it's a work." It's, again, you know, I, it's just, you know, the thing that Billy said, one of the things that Billy said really struck home with me, too. He was talking about catch wrestling, but he said, you know, it's dying because of the old-timers are gone. And I'm thinking, wow, you're singing the same song I'm singing here, you know, or Harley's going to sing, or J.J. Dillon has said when guys from our generation stop training, that is, you know, it's over, it's gone, you know. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I was just saying, that's, you know, it's like, I didn't know that was a Billy Riley quote. I think I've heard you say it, and I think we've talked about it on this show. It's like, learning how to learn with these, you know, guys who come in and actually think they know something, and it's, you know, no, you don't. You do actually have to learn these other things, and you have to reteach yourself on, you know, what the basics truly are. It's not, may have been what that guy taught you, because who taught him? It's, you know, it's resetting everything and then, yeah, getting it on track.
Sure. Well, you know, and that's one of the hardest things too. And I'm sure a lot of people don't understand. You know, they talk about the things going on at Florida Championship Wrestling in the developmental system. It's not that, you know, again, I don't know everybody's down. You know, DeMond is extremely capable, as was Dr. Tom, as is Ricky Steamboat. You know, I'm not sure who the hell is. Terry Taylor's down there. Terry's qualified as well. You're getting some guys that have been in the business for a long time and have got some bad habits or taught improperly to do certain things. And breaking those old bad habits and retraining them is tougher sometimes than taking somebody who has no, you know, has no clue and starting from scratch. I know and of course, I cannot explain it in a, you know, in an audio, you know, on a video or something, you could demonstrate it. But Dr. Tom, I know he with a headlock takeover, he would say, Les taught you this. I know, because you're doing it. But there were a certain way, if you tried to take him over in a, you know, with a side headlock takeover, he wouldn't go. He'd block you because it wasn't, he didn't feel comfortable in taking the bump that way. Somebody had taught, you know, this particular person. It wasn't necessarily, it was totally wrong, but it just, the positioning of that, of the person doing the throw, their body was in the wrong position. And the mechanics are, you know, you see a lot, you know, Missy Hyatt's always saying, why do these guys want to do stuff where they keep getting dropped on their heads? And I question that too. It's, you know, some of the stuff they do is just, it's extremely dangerous, and it's amazing. I'm amazed that more of these guys aren't, you know, aren't hurt and aren't out with serious injuries a lot sooner. I, you know, and I guess that, you know, you attribute that to their conditioning and the fact that they are, you know, are agile and younger and more flexible.
Oh, but Jesus, I was thinking that same thing, though. And, you know, as great as that main event match was, it between Daniels, Kazarian, Angle, and Styles, Styles is one of those guys, and I don't want to say he's the worst at it, because he's learned to control himself over the, God, I've been watching him now for I don't know how many years. So he's learned when to do things a lot better, but he did a springboard moonsault at the end of that match down onto Daniels. That was like, yeah, I don't know. You know, the amount of dives, and yes, the athleticism is amazing, but it's stuff like that, though, is what got Jesse Neal hurt. Or not Jesse Neal, I'm sorry, I can't think of the kid, Jesse Sorensen hurt, when he took an unneeded bump from Zema Ion in a situation that it didn't make any sense. It just, there was no reason for it. Yes, there was a reason for Styles to do it, but it was still a cringeworthy thing where, I don't know, it was very spectacular, but it's scary to watch. And, you know, you talk about Dr. Tom blocking the takeover because he wasn't comfortable taking the bump. I know Lance, we'll talk a lot when he talks to Brian about things he has coming up, and you know, he accidentally got hurt at the ROH show, but he doesn't take any bumps from anybody that he's not comfortable with either. is a lot of the issue with the mechanics. You know, there's one part of the aesthetic about making yourself look good and doing it, but the other part of this whole thing is, hey, yeah, it's a work. You need to protect that guy. I mean, that guy's life is in your hands. Does that have anything to do with it, too? Because that it makes me wonder. The women obviously always do that to me, just because of how they're built and their size, as well as the fact that they're so inexperienced. Are we looking, because of the mechanics, down the line of somebody who will get hurt?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think. Well, you know, here's the thing. It's like these guys, girls, whatever, it's like they get in this game of, can you top this? You know, can you top this? Well, you did this bump, so I'm going to do a bigger bump. And it's not the bigger bump. I don't care if it's a punch, a kick, a bump, a hold. It's not how much you do, how often it's doing it at the right time to make it effective. And so it's not, you know, I watch some of these multi-chop and punch sequences, and really, if these guys stop to think about this, it really just makes it look like, wow, these guys, they're ineffective. You know, they don't throw good. I mean, you know, you exchange, I mean, let's face it, Mike, you don't have to be a tough guy. You don't have to be a professional anything. If you hit me as hard as you can 10 times and I don't go down, you're not hitting very hard. But I'm sure that, if I stand there and try to take 10 shots from you, it's not going to work. I am, at some point, you're going to hit the hand, you know, you're going to ring the bell, and I'm at least going to sag and go to, well, you know, and it's like you watch the Ultimate Fighter finals, and I don't remember all these kids' names. But the one kid that threw the one beautiful kick to the side of the guy's head, and that guy was out before he hit the deck.
Yeah.
Right? So why would I see 16 kicks and the guy that's getting kicked gets up and does 31 moonsaults? I mean, what am I to believe this? Or am I just to look at it as, okay, cool, that was really neat. And, you know, that's...
Well, yeah. In its context, in context of that affects other matches, too. And I know, I'll use the Japanese example because I'm a little bit more familiar with it, but it's, you know, in the first match, not a whole lot would happen. You know, guy doesn't move. You know, it finishes the match. Then the second match goes on. Then the third was comedy, but it went up. Maybe the guy kicked out of the move that the two guys did in the first match, and it finished a guy. Guy kicks out of that at one, creates some draw, and then it moves its way up the card. Where, you know, they were talking about Kali's, Alberto Del Rio's concussion, which is very unfortunate in that he got it in a spot up on the ramp where he hit his head on the big WWE logo that's up there on the top of the ramp.
Right.
But they're now trying to play it off that Great Kali gave him that injury with a big chop to the head. Now, how often is that chop to the head used? You know, this would drive me nuts, especially in WCW, where
right.
It's happening in WWE now because things are so all over the place. Dick Murdoch's brainbuster used to lay a guy out for good. But then, you know, it got to the point where a brainbuster, guys were kicking out in the first match, and then it would do this way. And it just became, it infects everything else. And
well,
I think that's
the,
sorry,
yeah,
go ahead,
that's
Les,
the
sorry.
Point. And the thing of it is, once everybody does it, then it's not special, and if you're kicking out of it, it's obviously not, you know, it's not effective. And the guy kicking out may look stronger, but then the guy giving it looks weaker. So I mean, it's a trade off, and it doesn't do anything for anybody. You're right. It's just. And that's the thing, you know. I think we've probably mentioned here before as an example, Mid-Atlantic territory. They had 55 guys on the roster. If you were to come in there and you were going to be used, relatively good. I mean, you weren't just there to get other guys over. One of the first things they're going to ask you, the booker's going to ask you, is what do you use for finish, and you may be told, no, you can't use that here because so-and-so, that's his finish. And you damn sure can't use it for a high, you know, for just a spot and have somebody kick out of it. I mean, it was like George Scott and Johnny Weaver used to sleep for, you know, as an example. I don't remember what the hell everybody used, Mike, to be honest with you. But, you know, they protected people's finishers. And that was the deal. When you knew when Johnny Weaver hooked that sleeper, you could start putting your coat on. It was time to go home. And it made it effective. And you didn't see 15 guys using it and people kicking out of it. And, you know, or like the, you know, well, when Jake was using the DDT, right? When Jake hit the DDT, it was time to go home. And now that's a high spot. Well, I'm not going to, again, I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, but I was talking to a young man who is a very talented worker who had sat down with another guy who's a talented worker. One of them works for an international company, and they had DVR'd the ROH show, which aired the Steen and Richards match. And this guy told me that they didn't finish watching the match.
Which would not be an uncommon theme when it comes to Davey Richards matches over the last couple of pay-per-views.
Well, did you see the last Edwards Richards match?
Yes.
Were you impressed?
I
honestly, were you impressed?
No.
Okay, that's all I need. I watched it and I thought, wow, you know, it was a series of moves and. It just
that's
meant
the thing,
nothing.
Not reading the crowd, and that's been my. And again, this is not hammering down on Davey Richards or anything like that, but he's an example of, you know, if you're not reading the crowd, it once was bad enough that when it happened in December and they went long and the pay per view took forever, and but then to do it again and again, the Steam match I think was a little bit different, but it is to me a problem. That is a problem, and it's a problem not only – it's a problem in a lot of places, but Ring of Honor, you know, gets the worst hit of it, and he gets the worst hit of it, but it's the truth. It's the truth. It goes on too long. The moves stop mattering. The kicks stop mattering. Is it an athletic display? Sure. I can't do it. I can't physically do it. Don't think I'll ever – even if I was in the best of shape, don't think I have the dexterity to do it. But with that said, as a fan watching – I'm not surprised people just cannot last their way through it. It doesn't surprise me in the least. It doesn't surprise me in the least.
Well, you know, again, it's going for the cheap pop, or I'm not sure the value of it, but it's not, you know, you don't have, and you're right, you got to listen to the crowd. The best, you mentioned earlier about learning, As I came up through the ranks, and even after it didn't matter if I'd been working 15 years, there were heels that you could go out there and just go along for the ride. You knew how good this guy was, and when he said it's time to start your comeback, you realized that he had paid attention to those people, and he felt he had taken his offensive part of the match to the point where if we went any farther with it, it was going to start downhill. We were going to lose him, and it was time to get that baby face back in the game and to go with it. And I mean, it was just there were people like that. Excuse me. We had Dutch Mantel on. Was it a year ago? I don't even remember the last time we had Dutch on, but. I said, Dutch, talk about Nelson Royal as a ring general. It's one of the greatest ring generals, in the world, ever. I mean, this guy had an ear for the people, and his timing was just impeccable. I mean, it was just amazing how talented he was in that respect. But that was a part of the business, and it wasn't just going out there to do things to get them done. And I hear stories like that, too, Mike, that somebody will say, well, you know, I was laying out a finish, and this guy said, well, I need to get this, I want to do this move. And the other guy says, well, you know, in the context of this finish, it doesn't fit. Yeah, but I need to get it in. Well, no, you don't need to get it. You know, I don't know how many thousands of matches I've had. I'll be quite frank with you, you know, a 20-year career. But I mean, unless there was a stipulation that involved a particular move, I never went to the ring thinking I have got to do this or the match won't be any good. We just went out there to put together the best match we knew how, and, you know, some nights we didn't. I mean, every one of them wasn't a great, you know, I mean, you know, it's baseball. The greatest baseball pitchers in the world have an off night. The greatest hitters, you know, Pujols was cold as hell on home runs the first part of this season. I mean, nobody's perfect. I mean, my God, that's not even the point. But you're right. Listening to the crowd is such an important part of professional wrestling. And, you know, there's times that's one of my, now you talk about relearning or teaching how to learn. I know that every young guy watches his own matches, right? One of my comments is, okay, listen to your match. Turn the audio, watch it. I mean, watch it all you want, but one time, just turn that volume up and see if you're taking the crowd where you're getting all excited and think you're doing this great move or something that's just, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread. If there's no reaction from that audience, then it's no good. I mean, it doesn't matter if you've done 15 rotations off the top buckle and landed on your index finger, you know, and balanced there. If the crowd isn't reacting, then it doesn't matter. It's not good. I mean, it may be difficult to perform that move. It may be acrobatically excellent, but if you get no reaction from the crowd, then it's of no value. That's the point. That's the thing I see in a lot of today's performance is wasted motion, wasted effort. With the guys when I had my school and we were training four times a week, in the midst of something, I may stop and say, why did you do that? And if you didn't have an answer, then my answer was there was no need to do it then. You know, why? You know, there's no reason to have wasted effort. It's the minor little things that you put together. It's just like if I knock you down, I'm going to count to myself 1,001, 1,002. If you're not moving to come up, then I'm moving to come down. One of the craziest things I see, and the people we've talked about are guilty of this, but it's not just them either. It's like, this is the most important match of my life, Mike, and I've just knocked you down, and now I'm going to turn around, look at the audience, make faces at the audience, and turn around and wait for you to get up. Why the hell am I waiting for you to get up?
Yes. Yes.
Why am I not covering you and letting you kick out, and then it's more, and let you come up out of it? You know? I mean, I think about these things, and the way I try to teach is, how does professional wrestling, which is a work, parallel a real fight or a real match? And that's what we were just talking about there. Doesn't parallel anything that makes any sense, except you're trying to entertain. You know, you're overemphasizing the entertainment part of it is the problem. Billy mentioned that too, I believe, did he not?
He did indeed, and we're going to do a little break here. We'll talk a little bit more about this afterwards too. But it always makes me laugh. I mean, you talk about the playing to the crowd, and we mentioned the Undertaker and Triple H, and exactly probably zero were the amount of times that they would play to the crowd. They did facials, they did things to, you know, mentally, you know, entice the crowd and get them involved psychologically into what they were doing and get them emotionally involved in what they were doing, but. Anybody out there that I think has probably ever had a real fight or was in a competition, when it gets, especially in a fight, I block other people out. I don't play to the crowd. I didn't play to the people around me. I was in a fight, and that's where you should be in a wrestling ring, and that's it. I don't think that's a lost art because it still gets me involved and it still gets other people involved. Bryan Danielson and CM Punk's match a couple weeks ago proved that. But, again, I'm rambling on here. We'll go to a break, and then when we come back, a little bit more to talk about. I'll talk a little bit about that Pac-Bradley fight and then let everybody know what's going on here at the Georgia Wrestling History Community and what's going on with Bless and I. So we'll be back right after this break.
Georgia wrestling fans, you're going to want to make your plans to be at Johnny G's the first, third, and fifth Sunday of every month, 2 p.m. bell time, for Rampage Pro Wrestling television taping. And fans, if you're in Middle Georgia, make sure that you watch Rampage Pro Wrestling on Fox 24, Saturday 9 a.m. on the My 41.2, Saturday at 10 p.m. Cox Communications Cable, Thursday 8, Saturday at noon, and of course, Rampage Rewind, the one-half-hour show on Cox Communications throughout the schedule. Fans, be there.
Hi, I'm Jody Peterman. We know that no one understands what you need better than you do. We take care to guide you through the legal process, ensuring that you're able to make the decisions that are best for you. If you have a personal injury, criminal, or family law issue, please take a look at our website to learn more about our practice. We offer a free initial consultation for personal injury cases. Give us a call at 229-375-5680. We have a reputation for being accessible and treating our clients well. We look forward to hearing from you.
Hello, I'm Guy Terry of Terry and Peterman. At Terry and Peterman, we're committed to representing the hardworking residents of South Georgia in personal injury, criminal, and family law matters. For years, we have worked with college students in this area to ensure legal issues do not disrupt their academic careers. We also represent military families struggling with divorce and family law issues. We rely upon over 30 years of combined experience to provide aggressive representation for our clients.
This is Miss Rachel from The Empire, formerly known as Platinum Champions of Wrestling. Every Friday night, The Empire presents the best in professional wrestling at the Academy Theater in Avondale State. We're also at the Masquerade every month or so. Check us out on Facebook. Just look for Platinum Championship Wrestling. And you'll get the latest details on all the hottest action from The Empire, formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling. We get it. That's every Friday night at the Academy Theater and at the Masquerade as well every month. We'll see you there.
Hey, get rhythm. When you get the blues, come on, get a rhythm. When you get the blues, get a rock and roll feeling in your bones. Put taps on your toes and get gone, get a rhythm. When you get the blues, a little shoeshine boy, he never gets low down, but he's got the dirtiest job in town, bending low at the people's feet on a windy corner.
All right, we're back here on Ringside Rap, the legendary Les Thatcher, along with me, Mike Sempervivi, in our last segment here. And like I said before the break, I will, because I did, I'm an incredible masochist, so I did watch both the UFC on FX 3 show that took place from Florida, as well as the boxing pay-per-view on Saturday. And the UFC on FX3 pay-per-view, or I'm sorry, show that was for free, was actually very good. I don't know. I haven't seen a rating on how it went yet. Dana White wasn't happy with the show's ticket sales, but, you know, there's always a problem with Florida, and it's the same problem that sports has got, or at least professional sports has in Los Angeles. You really have to be putting on an event in Miami, seemingly, to get people, you know, enraptured by something. Look, the L.A. Kings won the Stanley Cup. I have a feeling midway through next year there's going to be a lot of empty seats there. That's just the kind of town it is. So while the crowd was a little bit disappointing, only 6,000, the show itself was actually really good. Mike Pyle went knockout of the night with a vicious shot. And that's what the good part. And I know Billy Robinson mentioned the negativities of promoters wanting fast knockouts and things like that. But the reality is, for a lot of TV viewers of this product, they salivate for stuff like that. And the show was really full of it. Really good fight between Eddie Wineland and Scott Jorgensen, where Wineland just threw a left jab, straight right combo that he was kind of setting Jorgensen up for, a right cross that he was setting him up for with a jab, and knocked him out in dramatic fashion in the second round. Mike Pyle's knockout at the end of the first round against Josh Neer was the left jab, straight right combo that he was working towards, and they were just some really, really fun things. Eric Silva defeated Charlie Brennan by rear naked choke. Also in the first round, it was that looked very, very good as well. And then the main event with Johnson and McCall, not as good as their first fight, not as close as their first fight, and no controversy here either. That ended up being a majority draw. But this time around, Demetrius Johnson goes on and gets the number one contendership to the 125-pound title. That was on Friday night. And then on Saturday was the Pacquiao-Bradley fight, which, you know, very simply, I wrote an article up on the Wrestling Observer site, which I was having split personalities writing it because I really wanted to write it from a purely professional wrestling point of view, with all of the media hand-wringing that came out afterwards and people being shocked and people looking for angles and was it set up and they already had props for the rematch ready and things like that. It was quite the sociological experiment late Saturday night and early Sunday morning, watching all the reviews and the comments come in, and especially in the next couple of days after that. But just for the record, I had Bradley winning two rounds, and he did put on a incredible performance in that he was standing there and was fine with fighting Pacquiao's fight. One of the reasons he hyped up a rematch so much before this first bout even took place was he was going to fight Manny's fight, and he knows Manny doesn't have a whole lot of fight options, so if he put on a good performance, odds are he could get a rematch in before Pacquiao were to move on to Floyd Mayweather, that all that nonsense business would start up again next year. So, you know, marketing-wise, he had a plan in mind, and physically he stayed in there. He took some good shots from Pacquiao, who was not at his A-game or on his A-game at all. But with that said, I could only give Bradley two rounds. At most, I could give him five, which would still get Pacquiao seven in a convincing two-round win. The judges, two of them didn't see it that way, gave Bradley the decision. A lot of people have said, well, this hurt the Manny Pacquiao, Floyd Mayweather prospects. Absolutely not, because they're still the only two guys that people want to see fight each other, unless Bradley were to go and knock Pacquiao out in this next fight. And something tells me I don't think that'll be the case. But if they can ever make Pacquiao and Mayweather, it certainly wasn't hurt by this this very poor judging decision.
You think, well, you know, Mike, people doing business is, I don't think that's anything new if that's what they were doing. But when it's obvious that somebody's doing business, then it becomes a sham, I think.
Well,
you know,
that was the damnedest thing to me, and I want to cut you off, but I watched the press conference afterwards, and Bob Arum he's calling out Keith Kaiser. Dana White did a lot worse on Twitter, because that's just his style, but was calling out the press guy, and this is a black eye for boxing. It's a death knell. Here we go again. And Bradley had this plan of a rematch anyway. But at the press conference, finally they roll Bradley out in a wheelchair because he hurt his feet. And I'm not even kidding you. They had a huge ticket touting November 10th for a rematch, a big oversized novelty like you, Ed McMahon presenting a check, had a ticket for Bradley Pacquiao too. And I just, and you got to answer this from a promotional aspect, being a guy who promoted things. I thought that was such bad form. Just because of how the decision was and everything that went with it, I was really surprised that Top Rank would let him stand there. I know they'll be the beneficiaries of this, and they do have a business to run, but I thought under the circumstances, to me that came across as bad form. What would you think as a promoter?
Wow. Well, you know, it's just, yeah, it's shady, obviously, and again, it's kind of like our business, right? I mean, where you just made the match 30 seconds ago, and the next screen you see up on the bumper going into the break is pictures and graphics already.
Yeah.
Wow, how'd that happen? I don't know.
must be the same guy who always seems to sneak that camera in there when people are talking backstage.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a shame. You know, and boxing doesn't need a black eye anyway. I mean, it's, you know, business hasn't been extremely good for boxing to begin with. I see where Ortiz is going to be the next inductee into the UFC Hall of Fame.
Yeah, and that, I tell you, that, I'm not saying it surprised me, but it's, With the relationship that Dana White and Tito Ortiz has, it's been a lot better recently. Obviously, Ortiz taking the Rampage Jackson fight on such short notice, you know, helped out his his case a lot. It's been so cantankerous for so long, but hopefully also, I don't even know if, because Tito's got a fight coming up on that card, I don't know if Dana even told him he was going to go in the Hall of Fame, because much like Chuck Liddell, he kind of retired Liddell when Liddell didn't want to, and he let him come up and fight again, but then basically retired Liddell again before he made it official. I wonder if that's kind of Dana's thing with Tito Ortiz because of his back. Or, you know, I know Ortiz has said he's going to be getting out, but you know how fighters and wrestlers are. They never seem to ever want to leave, no matter what they say.
Right.
If he's just kind of sending the salvo that, you know what, we're going to do this thing the nice way, and everything's great, and we'll smile, and, you know, as far as we're concerned, this is it for you unless you want to be an ambassador for us. And I hope that's the case, too, because Tito Ortiz, you know, again, to tie this back to Billy Robinson, kind of made his bones beating Frank Shamrock in the UFC. Frank Shamrock was a guy who trained at the Snake Pit and was, you know, a member of the Lion's Den with his brother for God knows how long in that style. And those guys, and this is, you know, one of the big drawbacks to catch wrestling, those guys hurt each other. They would work these holes and they hurt each other. There's a reason Ken Shamrock is in the condition he's in. A lot of these other guys, you know, forget about looking at their fingers and toes, much less their knees and their elbows and things like that. That style was very, very hard. And Ortiz, you know, even though he's an amateur wrestler and people consider him part of the modern time, he kind of came up in that era of what mixed martial arts used to be. So, yeah, that man and his poor body, it's probably time. And it's kind of sad, though, with all these injuries happening and the UFC having to change so many shows around. Yeah, I feel for them in a way because they're just not creating new stars fast enough for the amount of shows that they do run. And, you know, that to me is their biggest problem. Absolutely their biggest, biggest problem. And Rich just sent me a note over saying breaking news here. Floyd Mayweather, whose lawyers asked, I believe it was a day ago, to try to get him out of prison a little bit quicker, saying it could damage his career. He wanted house arrest over solitary confinement. A judge has just recently, from the AP here, his demands that he's being released from jail because of the poor quality of the food and water and has threatened his health were denied by a Las Vegas judge who says he should eat and drink what has been given to him behind bars. And, you know, I for one, am completely fine with that, especially considering this is a domestic violence charge that he's
right
in the pen for. So, I tell you, that's another thing I wrote in the article, too. You know, this fight with Manny Pacquiao, it felt like a $350,000 buy fight. It'll do more than that, probably. In fact, I'm sure it will. But, boy, this didn't feel like an event. And I was thinking when I was writing that article, it's amazing the visceral level that Floyd Mayweather gets people at. And the only thing I can compare him to is Mike Tyson, in that it's amazing that he has done some of the things that he's done, and they're such taboo things in today's society, especially with women and things like that and guns and taxes and the whole nine yards. And he continues to hold the social status that he does. Is the only thing I can compare it to is Tyson. It's so, so odd that people will shower him with the money and buy these pay-per-views so freely. And I'm not judging it or anybody for doing it, but yet Manny Pacquiao, who 2009 is one of the Times People of the Year, and he's a politician. And I'm not saying he doesn't have his own issues, his womanizing issues. His dedication to this fight was to me in question, and the fact that he needed so much time to warm up and he was going to watch the end of the Boston-Miami game, you know, come hell or high water, and wasn't warming up while doing it. You know, he's got his drawbacks as well, but it's amazing that Mayweather, people will flock to Mayweather, but yet not to Pacquiao. It's very interesting to me.
Yeah, it's a strange brew. But yeah, that's the fight that I guess is going to set all the pay-per-view records and attendance records if and when it happens. And,
you talk about you don't buy pay-per-view now. I'm not even joking with you. For anybody listening, I mean, the corporate sponsorship that will be behind that fight will be insane. Just everything that will go with it. It will be the biggest fight of all time, biggest drawing pay-per-view and the whole nine yards there. But they're talking about a $100 price tag.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure. I don't think we've made it this far in a society. It'll be interesting. I know that it'll make tons of money and people will do it, but I can't fathom a $99.99 price tag for a TV show, a pay-per-view boxing event. I can't either. If you put that on that, what the heck is the Super Bowl worth every year?
Yeah, God, yeah. Well, you know, speaking of selling and buying and everything, I understand that the WWE pay-per-view is, I don't know what this is doing for pay-per-view buys, but they're playing hell filling that building.
Oh, yeah.
They're running space. I talked to somebody today that that some of the wrestlers on the card are, and this is not the guy that told me this. It wasn't somebody high up on the card that offered it to him, but he said we're comping tickets. How many you need? And he said I could use 8. He said okay, you got them. And I guess they're selling what 4 for $60 or something like that on some kind of special, and then the $522 for some of the special seats aren't sold. Yeah, okay. But I'm thinking $522 for this card? Are you what? I mean, I can't even fathom that. I mean, please, I don't even understand how you can ask that kind of money for a wrestling card of any kind. I mean, just, you know, I mean, WrestleMania, I know they sell the hell out of that, but that's like, well, you mentioned Super Bowl, it's the same thing, but $522 for a, when I say ringside, I don't mean front row, I mean, these seats are like, I think he was saying F section or something, double F, whatever that is.
Oof.
Yeah, so.
God, that's insanity. That is, and somebody pays, there's a lot of people on the figure four board complaining about the fact that the UFC has changed things around so much and stuff like that, and it's like, and I understand the frustrations, but that's the thing you get when you buy a live sporting event ticket is hard subject to change. It sucks when it does, and you can try to do a make good if you're the promotion, and you can try to ask for something if you're the person that you felt, you know, if you feel wronged because of car changes and things like that. But I also put the blame on, I mean, the UFC charges to me way too much for their tickets. And I mean, way too much. And these boxing events too, but that's a different clientele that goes to those things. Somebody is paying for these seats, and that blows my mind. Absolutely just boggles and blows my mind that people will actually pay this money and corporations will pay this money for these seats. They had a chance to go to Yankee Stadium a couple weeks ago. And courtesy of Jim Beam, where they have a block of seats behind home plate, and it's always funny watching these baseball games with these seats that these corporations own, and they're owned by people in the public, and it's like, the Nationals, for example, as well as they're playing, the Lexus seats behind home plate, and there's nobody in them. Man, you know, I know you can write a lot of this stuff off as entertainment and the like, and you do it for clients and things like that, but real people will never go to sporting events, and the more they cost on pay-per-view and things like that, the less interest is going to be there, too, and it blows my mind that, again, these publicly held companies, and not that I'm complaining, I was a beneficiary of it, but, you know, my kid will never be able to go to sporting events like this because of the cost. And it's brutal. And I'm always stunned that people have the ability to pay for these things.
Yeah. Well, you know, when the Yankees were here playing the Cincinnati Reds, somebody was saying like $300 for a seat. And I said, unless A-Rod's going to detail my car, I don't think so. I'm not really interested. I mean, that's just, you know, that's absurd. I mean, to me anyway. I mean, I can sit here and watch that baseball game in the comfort of my home. I don't have to pay $8 for a beer or whatever the hell the current charge is. And, you know, another thing, I mean, it's really not about the game in so many ways. I know back to around opening day, it was one of the guys at the gym was saying that he and his dad had tickets for opening day or for a game, and I forget what the price was, but it was, I thought, absorbent. And I said, my God, that's, I don't want to pay that much for a, well, you know, you get the all you can eat buffet, and I think it was $200 or $300, and I said, I don't eat that much food in a month, never mind in a 9-inning baseball game. And he said, plus you can shoot pool or shoot, it was one of, like, you know, one of these club seats. You shoot pool or shoot basketball. I said, here's my question. You're going to pay that much money to see a baseball game. Why the hell would you shoot basketball or pool? I mean, yeah. Wouldn't you watch the baseball game? For that kind of money, I think I want to play in it. Never mind. But,
yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just, I guess it's the thing to say I was there, you know, opposed to actually, and, you know, do you get, the game's boring, I'll go shoot a game of pool. Or baskets or whatever, I don't know. It's just, it's, well, of course, part all this might comes down to what the baseball, what the players are getting paid, what, you know, the cost of the stadium and this and that and the other thing. So it's, you know, and where at some point it's got to stop. I mean, when I say it's got to stop, it really obviously doesn't, but how, you know, what is the saturation point?
Either that or there's going to be some sort of I don't know, I'd say a fan revolution or something like that, because it's like you were saying, it's amazing. Yeah, and I Camden Yards opened up while I was still in Baltimore, and I remember, I mean, Memorial Stadium to Camden Yards, and you got these amenities, and there was all this cool stuff, and it looked cool, and as great as it was in hindsight, it kind of led to some bad. And again, this is with everything has got to be bigger and all these amenities and nonsense and things like that. But went to the Flyers playoff game, and it was like, you know, somebody's paying for these seats. You're in the bar or the smoking lounge or sitting in the club set, and you're watching or doing something else. And it's like, man, there's real fans out there that would kill to be in here. And it's going to, again, $99.99 pay-per-views and these exorbitant seats and, you know, real
people. Yeah, the average fan, I mean, it's like you say, corporations or young professionals with a lot of disposable income. It's just, I mean, the average person cannot, you know, afford it. The Dayton Dragons, which is one of the Cincinnati Reds farm clubs in Dayton, you know, it's just like, well, depending on where you live in Cincinnati, somewhere from 40 to 60 some miles up I-75. But the Dayton Dragons, I've never been to one of their games, but they have a great little ballpark. They say the atmosphere is good. It's well put together. It's clean. It's, you know, and they at reasonable prices. And they have like a playground for kids and stuff. One of my clients took his grandson with him to a game up there, but he was saying that they're pretty much sold out all the time, but that's affordable, you know. I mean, if you you look at the economy and one thing and another, it's just, my God, it's just, you know.
Yeah, I don't know how it is for other sports, but, you know, living here, I get I get a bunch of, now that the Nationals being here too, I get access to a bunch of as much minor league baseball as I want, not a whole lot of minor league hockey. You know, it's super close, although the Norfolk Admirals, making your old former stomping grounds of the Scope proud, they just won the Calder Cup in the American Hockey League, being the Toronto Marlies over the weekend. So good on them. But, yeah, I mean, minor league baseball, it's, again, like you were saying about that place, that Salisbury here and Bowie and Aberdeen and some of these other – beautiful stadiums, great atmosphere, stuff for kids, you know, because, you know, the prices are so conducive with taking them, and it is one of the fun things left here. And I said, oh, man, I didn't realize it's almost 10 o'clock here, too, so I do want to mention tomorrow night on the show on Peach State Pandemonium and an open forum with Jerry Oates, Bobby Simmons, and Mike Norris over there, and coming here next week. Very, very happy to have on. I guess we can call him an ROH superstar now. We don't have to call him just an OVW superstar, but an ROH one now as well. Mike Mondo is going to be joining us. So, Les, sorry to run so long here. What do you got coming up this week?
Well, Saturday, you know, we got Vic Socia. We got Alex Marvez on the Wrestling Weekly, Doc Young's Wrestling
awesome.
Weekly show this week. he's going to be on with us. And, well, actually, it'll probably be posted either Friday evening or Saturday at some point on the Observer. And then tomorrow, Mike Johnson and I, wake up, Les. Mike Johnson and I have Wrestler's Eye Radio on Insider. I'm gonna have an announcement of sorts I'm saddened that we're not doing the Legends in Charlotte this year. Of course, you know, Greg Price's health is the reason for that, and we're hoping Greg gets healthy and would do it next August. I'm going up to Western Canada. Not sure the dates. I should know that in a week or so. For about a week in September. For Vance Nevada to work with some of the wrestlers up there and attend some of the shows. And I will be looking for some wrestling talent. When we've got more time, probably maybe next week or the following week, I'll go over some of that with you, and I'll have more details on that. But anyway, that's kind of what's happening with me.
Awesome. Yeah, I do want to talk about it next week, and I won't even bother anybody with mine. I'm Mike, Big Audio Nightmare, Brian Alvarez, and I this Sunday on Wrestling Observer Live. And for everybody out there who's a father, come this Sunday. Happy Father's Day. If you're anything like me, you'll probably, you know, ask for quiet, ask just for maybe a little bit of breakfast and to be left alone and not have the kid yell at you, and that will last probably about 15 minutes.
There you go.
So hopefully it goes a lot better for everybody else out there. And thank you, everyone. And thank you, Billy Robinson. And can't wait till Mike Mondo next week. See everybody next week.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.